A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 3, 1985, in the series Lifelines, entitled Living with Wonder. The text for the sermon is Isaiah 6, verse 1. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
In the year that John F. Kennedy died, I know where I was. On the day that he died, I know what I was doing, and on the weekend of his death and burial, I remember events vividly. It may have been something like that with Isaiah. It was in the day that King Uzziah died, or the year that King Uzziah died, that he says, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. It may have been the occasion of the king's death, a crisis in the national political life, or it could have been the annual enthronement of the king, an annual celebration. But whatever it was, Isaiah was in the temple, and it was a time of festival worship, the corporate worship of the people of God. There was the priesthood officiating at the altar. There was the smoke of incense rising heavenward. There was the sound of the blaring trumpets, and the people of God gathered in expectation, bringing their adoration and praise. And in the midst of it all, there was a transforming moment. And Isaiah says, I saw the Lord. I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And in that experience, that vision, Isaiah's life was cleansed and claimed and commissioned. In that transforming moment, his life was changed. And from that moment, his life flowed, characterized by a sense of wonder. Everything was changed. Nothing was the same. Isaiah, in the moment of revelation, when his eyes beheld the glory of God in the midst of the corporate worship of the people of God, found himself cleansed and claimed and commissioned. And he went forth from that time with his ordinary days transformed and with the mundane and routine issues of life made extraordinary, charged with energy, illumined with radiance. His life was made over again. It was in the moment of worship, as he was gathered in the community of faith, as his heart was lifted up in prayer and adoration, that there was a rift in the sky and a blinding light. And he says, I saw the Lord. That experience speaks of the potential of corporate worship, of the possibility of that which might happen whenever the people of God are gathered in the praise of his name. And I commend to you today the discipline of corporate worship. I commend to you the weekly appointment with the people of God gathered in Jesus' name to offer him praise and to magnify him and give him the glory that is due his holy name. I offer to you the regular appointment of corporate worship with the people of God as a lifeline. Not regular worship as a heavy duty, as a legalistic necessity, as it were to endure it and thereby take care of the Sunday obligation. No, in this series of messages entitled Lifelines, I suggest to you that this weekly appointment with the people of God in the worship of his name is indeed a lifeline, and that when pursued in a disciplined fashion, becomes a means by which we are formed and shaped as the people of God. I do you no favor to allow you to be haphazard, nonchalant about the regular worship of God in the community of His people. Not because somehow or other God is deprived, although that is true, but can we add to His glory? Not because somehow or other we can thereby curry His favor, as though we have then done what was expected of us, and therefore we put Him under obligation. No. I commend to you the regular worship of God in the midst of the community of faith, as that point at which your life stands at the place where lightning may strike, where the transforming moment may happen, where you might see the Lord in all of His glory and live from that moment changed, your life full of wonder, living with wonder, living with wonder. It's such a grand possibility. But it is not taken advantage of by very many. For it is so easy to get locked in to the spirit of the age and become a prisoner of the present culture. We can find the life and vitality wrung right out of our spirits as we get ourselves all entwined in the execution of our duties and our responsibilities and the fulfilling of our vocations and our professions. As we are impinged upon by all of the pressures that crowd upon us in the horizontal plane of our lives, as our lives are enwebbed in a network of responsibilities and relationships, if there is not that vertical dimension, that penetration from beyond, that invasion of transcendence, life can be so mundane, such a bore. We become the prisoners of that one-dimensional existence which is subhuman, living with wonder, is living with a conscious awareness of God. Living with wonder is to comprehend all of life in all of the breadth and depth of its mystery, is to live with a consciousness of the majesty and the mystery of the eternal God, whose everlasting arms support us and who overshadows us with His wings. To live with wonder is to go through the world with its blue heavens above as though they were a vaulted cathedral, in the consciousness that this is our Father's world. And no matter what the press of the day, there is always something more. No matter what the fullness of our life may bring, there is always another dimension. There is always the possibility of being sprung free, unlocked, allowed to soar with the eagles, and living with wonder comes from the transforming moment. And the transforming moment is most likely to occur where God has promised to reveal His glory. I recommend to you the corporate worship of the people of God as a spiritual discipline by which we stand in the way of His revelation, in the way of His illumination, and the radiance of His presence, which will transform the ordinariness of our lives into that extraordinary existence that He desires for us all. Isaiah saw the Lord, and he said, "Woe is me, I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, aware of his unworthiness, overwhelmed by God's presence." And in that gracious action, the taking of the coal from off the altar, the touching of his lips, the speaking of the word of forgiveness, which prepared Isaiah to hear the call, "Who will go for us? Whom shall I send?" And to respond, "Here am I, send me." It is out of the experience of worship, confronted with the glory of God, knowing the transforming moment that everything is different and a whole new world is born. Think with me for a few moments about that action in which we are now consciously engaged. And as we do that, I have to begin with the problems I face. For you must recognize, and I must acknowledge, that I cannot guarantee that that will happen for everyone, nor even for anyone. God is free. God is sovereign. God reveals Himself. God gives the vision of Himself. God is not some object of magical manipulation. He is not some genie that I can rub and therefore set before you in order to dazzle you with His radiance. God is not at our disposal. And so I am speaking about something to which I can point, but I can only point to a reality that transcends the possibility of my creation. I can only speak about a happening that I cannot make happen. I can only speak about a moment that I cannot create. And a second problem which follows from that is that to speak about worship is not necessarily to worship. Right now, you and I are engaged, hopefully, mind to mind. The living voice speaks in reasonable, logical discourse. I must try to be reasonable. I must try to be logical. I must try to be clear so that you can follow what I am trying to say. And in trying to be logical and reasonable, I am trying to bring you along with me in a discussion, in a discourse, which is a rational discourse, which is a reasonable discussion. And in doing so, we are using our minds, we are exercising our reason. And this is important and this is necessary, but we must recognize that we are already stepping back from ourselves and stepping back out of this corporate experience to reflect on it. And to reflect on worship is not synonymous with worship. And this has been, of course, one of the great problems of our Reformation tradition, where the sermon has been so central. In no way would I downplay the sermon, but let me say that many of us were brought up and were conditioned to measure the effectiveness of a Sunday morning on the basis of the effectiveness of the sermon. It is in this moment, when your mind is engaged and I speak to you, that we move into that rational discussion together. And I am particularly aware of it now when I am speaking about worship, which transcends reason, that I can only speak to you about it in a reasonable fashion. And as we reflect on it, we are not necessarily doing it. Now, this is an important moment, for our worship, our devotion, our commitment is based on the truth. And the strength of our Reformation tradition has been that the faith has been articulated and we have addressed the mind. But we must recognize that in addressing the mind and talking about worship, we are not yet at that point or in that experience of which we are speaking. And so you must recognize that I am pointing you in a reasonable fashion to an experience that shatters reason. I am pointing you to an experience. I am pointing you to an encounter, to that which will grasp your whole being, that will shake you to the core, that will cause fear and trembling, that will be full of glory. And I do it in this way, stammeringly, stumblingly, conscious of the fact that that about which I am speaking is an experience beyond mere understanding. Rudolf Otto wrote a classic study of this whole matter called The Idea of the Holy, and in that he said, the feeling remains where the concept fails. And the concept is the reasonable, rational discussion. And when I come to have said all that I can say, and the concept fails, and I've hit the limit of the possibility of rational discourse, and if I have been successful in leading you to that point, I have not yet been able to bring you into the experience of which I speak. For the experience of which I speak is the engagement of the whole person. And so let us be very conscious that while we are reflecting on worship, that upon which we reflect is the total engagement of the whole person, the mind, the heart, the soul, the will, caught up and lost in the glory of God. Well, I have great problems, you must admit, but I will nonetheless attempt to say one or two things about worship in our reflection upon it, in order that perhaps if the sky is not rent and the glory doesn't filter through, that nonetheless we'll at least be more conscious of what we are about when we gather here. Let me say in the first place that our worship is response to God. Our worship is response to God. We come here to offer to God. God has taken the initiative. The great divide between those who take religion seriously and those who write it off is the divide between those who see religion as response and those who see religion as self-generated, the projection of human need. Those who see religion as human projection arising out of human need obviously are saying that religion is purely human and that there is no objective counterpart to our worship, but rather that which we have created out of our own need and projected onto the screen of eternity, then we bow down to worship. And that is why there are so many who have followed that train of thought which goes from Feuerbach through Marx and through Freud and has permeated the whole of modern culture. That is why so many have been done with worship. And indeed, I would be done with it if that's all I believed it were, because if this is not more than good therapy, if this is not more than good psychology, if this is not more than to give people a lift and enough courage to get through another week, frankly, it's not serious enough for me to give my life to it. Worship is response to God. It is reaction. It is reflex. It is response to that which has first of all encountered us. And down through the centuries, the human being seems intrinsically constituted so that this response is offered, which would say to me that the Creator has put something in the very fabric of the being of the creature that reaches out and longs to be in communion with the transcendent reality beyond us. Worship is response. So that then worship is something that we do Godward. It is something that we do Godward. It is an offering. We are here to worship, to praise, and to adore the good and gracious God who has revealed Himself to us. That means that we may not measure worship by whether or not there is instruction and edification. Now, certainly instruction and edification are noble ends. And I would hope that we would not come here week after week without there occurring instruction and edification. But frankly, my good people, edification and instruction are not the end of worship. Worship has its end in the adoration of God. And if we come here passively to be entertained, or even passively in a positive sense to be instructed or edified, we have entered the doors for the wrong reason, Because worship is something that happens Godward. It is ascribing to God His worth-ship. And obviously then, worship is not entertainment. Worship is not entertainment. And it may not be measured by whether or not one is held in rapt attention for 60 or 70 or 80 minutes. Worship may not be measured by its entertainment factor. To say that in our day, a day in which we are bombarded by the media with all of the possibilities that that presents, coming at us throughout all the avenues of our apprehension, to say that in a day when the television worship is entertainment par excellence is to swim upstream. But worship is not entertainment. I know, although I am a hopeless romantic and a hopeless idealist, that if your interest is not held, and that if you are not gripped and grasped, that you will fall away. I know to think that people would come week after week after week in spite of the offering, simply to offer to God the praise of which He is worthy, is to expect too much. But I must nonetheless draw the line and say that if we come here for any other reason, we have not yet come here for the preeminent reason. God is worthy of our praise, and worship is response to Him, and it is something that happens Godward. Let me say then that worship certainly can occur in the community of faith in various ways. There is the simplicity of the Quaker meeting house, and there is the exuberance of the charismatic Pentecostal service, and there is the solemn dignity of evensong in a magnificent cathedral. And we are all different, and what moves one may not move another. But let me suggest to you my conception or ideal of worship, that which I pray over and try here week after week to create. You have never heard this probably before. You'll never read it in a book on worship, but let me suggest that worship of the people of God ought to be a carefully choreographed pageant. A carefully choreographed pageant. If you look up the word pageant, you'll find that it is a spectacle created for effect. And if you look further, you'll find that it speaks of splendor and pomp. And if you look up pomp, you'll see that it is defined as magnificence and as splendor. And I am suggesting that worship week by week in the community of faith ought to be a carefully choreographed pageant that has elements of magnificence and pomp and splendor about it. I am suggesting that the pageant aspect creates the greatest possibility for the invasion of the eternal God into our time and space. I am suggesting to you that the pageantry is well choreographed in order that the event might happen. Because again, I can't create the event. I can't guarantee that it will happen. There is no magical ritual that I can go through, no set of words I can repeat, no sacramental act in which we can engage that will rip open the heavens and bring God down. But this we can do. We can create a spectacle for effect. What effect? The effect of the vision of God, in which is a transforming moment, out of which comes a life full of wonder, a life transformed. Pageantry pomp, if you read further in the definitions, you'll find that they can also be used pejoratively in a negative sense, as a hollow display. And worship always treads that fine line between a carefully choreographed pageant in order to create the framework wherein the lightning might strike, and the hollow display that can seem to be just fluff and frill. But where it is engaged in seriously, where it is prayed over carefully, where it is carefully choreographed from the opening chord of the organ to the last notes of the postlude, where every movement and every prayer and every offering and every expression is carefully thought out in order to create an effect, there you have the potential, there you have the structure, there you have the form in which the lightning might strike, in which all of it might become transparent, in which there might be a rift in the sky and the revelation of the radiant glory of the eternal God. And of course, it is that for which we pray and that toward which we work, and with that expectation in which we gather, and because we know that what we are doing is something more than appealing to the mind and giving a truth into the intellect, because we know that we are looking for the transforming movement which involves the vision, which engages the whole person, we know that it is not enough simply with reasonable discourse to lead one into the truth, but we use every possible available prop, every available means in order to engage the whole person. We use fabric and we use color and we use symbol, we use vestments, we use candles reminding us that Jesus is the light of the world. We use a rose to speak of the gift of new life, and we light this candle when one dies, noting that the community is a community militant looking forward to being the community triumphant. In all of it, in all of the experiences, when we gather with a great hymn, with choir and congregation, and as one voice singing praise to Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, when there is the great procession, when the cross is lifted high, when with simple gesture the bread is broken saying, "This is my body," and when the cup is poured out saying, "This is my blood," when the waters of baptism and the sign of the cross are placed on the forehead of a child, in all of it, the community gathers together. It relives its history. It enters again into the mystery. It exposes itself to the glory. And it prays, "God, smite me now." That's what it's all about. And if you come next week, there may even be incense. That's what it's all about. Oh, there's no cleverness that can guarantee that it'll happen. There's no genius of religious insight or spiritual sensitivity that can simply turn it on. But if we are serious, and if we are attentive, and if we are alert, and if we are aware, and we offer ourselves here, then it may just happen as it happened to Isaiah. In a transforming moment, all of life may be changed, and from that moment, be full of wonder. Then it is that I am ready to hear His voice, to know myself claimed, cleansed, and commissioned to service. Then it is when I have been engaged with the living God that I am ready for that climactic act, which is not the final word of the sermon, but the offering of ourselves through the offering of our gifts. And we can sense it right here. when the organ begins to build. And we know that finally, as the gifts are brought forward and the people stand, that we are at that climactic moment of offering ourselves to God, who graciously has claimed us, cleansed us, and sends us forth to be His people. Ah, to meet this weekly appointment is to put oneself in the place where lightning strikes, and to go forth full of wonder, living with heaven on earth.